This is Audible.
William Morrow and Harper Audio present American Tantrum, The Donald J. Trump Presidential Archives, by Anthony Atamanik with Neil Casey. Forward by Howard Feynman. Read by Anthony Atamanik, Kathy Griffin, Tom Arnold, Neil Casey, John Gemberling, and Lennon Parham. To my mom, my stepfather, my dad, and my intelligent, beautiful, and patient wife, Flossie.
I alone can fix it.
Donald J. Trump.
This and no other is the root from which a tyrant springs. When he first appears, he is a protector.
Plato. The Project. Archivist's Note. An Introduction to the Presidential Pocket Library. Since this is the introduction, I thought I might as well introduce myself. My name is Kelsey Nelson. I'm a golf writer and golf wronger, turned editor turned columnist. My regular readers can feel free to play through this section and get a good table down at the 19th hole. I spent 15 years as an editor at Golf and Stream magazine, then 10 more as an editor-at-large, they swear the title has nothing to do with my waistline, writing my monthly column, Mulligan's Wake. My wife, Peg, and I are semi-retired in Florida, where we are members in good standing and better stumbling at Mar-a-Lago, the golf club where I first had the pleasure of meeting Donald J. Trump a few years before he became the 45th president of the United States. To set the scene, it was a beautiful spring Wednesday, about a quarter past happy hour. I was at the edge of the fairway looking for the ball that got away when I heard someone stomping and grunting in the brush. I pushed a branch aside and saw a lumpy man pick up his own ball and toss it back towards the green. That gentleman was none other than Donald J. Trump, owner of the course, celebrity billionaire, and future president of the United States. He tiptoed away before I could introduce myself, but later that night in the dining room, I was surprised to feel a hand on my shoulder. I turned around, fully expecting to see an old friend or waiter there to tell me, "You've had enough, Kelsey." But instead, there he was again, larger than life, the Donald. This time with a big grin on his face. "Did you see anything today?" I remember him asking. "I don't think so, Mr. Trump. Maybe just the owner of the greatest golf course in the world testing out some new green regulations," I answered with a twinkle in my eye that he promptly returned. And so we became fast friends. It was a friendship that paid dividends. The Trump Organization started inviting me to cover the openings of their new golf courses for my magazine. Not only did I get to travel all over the world and have first swing, not to mention second and third, at some beautiful virgin links, I also started attending their super luxe VIP charity events, including the one where a guy won a hole-in-one contest and went on to greedily sue the Trump Foundation for the money he'd been promised in one of the most unsportsmanlike episodes I've ever encountered. For more details, see my column Bogey on the Unfairway, September 2012. We lost touch when Mr. Trump started to focus on his political career and his company started focusing on international real estate projects. But when my friend Donald was elected president, I raised a glass. When he invited me to come to the White House, I nearly dropped one. It was 8:15 a.m. in Florida a few weeks after the inauguration. My wife, Peg, was sizzling up some turkey bacon while I was reading the newspaper on the Nordic track. My cell phone buzzed with a call from a blocked number. Fearing yet another telemarketer, see my June 2016 article, Perverse Mortgages, I was going to let it go to voicemail, but something told me to pick up. Peg. I'm kidding, dear. On the other end of the line was the unmistakable New York accent belonging to the 45th President of the United States. He said he had just woken up from a dream that he didn't want to tell me about. But he remembered me and my articles fondly and offered me the position of presidential librarian and archivist on the condition that I could come to Washington, D.C. immediately and start assembling the documents that would comprise this volume, the first ever presidential pocket library, which the president insisted we publish before the opening of the Obama Presidential Library in Chicago. Before the bacon was even cold, I had given Peg a kiss and hopped the first flight to our nation's capital, where I checked into a hotel and made fast friends with the bartenders at the Capitol Grill, and that's Capitol with an A. The next morning, I was asleep in my clothes in my room at the Hilton Garden Inn when my phone rang at 9 o'clock on the dot. Expecting to hear the robotic voice of the automatic wake-up call, I gave my best Frank Nelson greeting to what turned out to be an unamused man from the Secret Service. He told me that they weren't going to wait for the results of my background check so I could swing by the White House whenever. As it turns out, the FBI found out that some of the president's best guys had a few lovers' quarrels in their past, so the administration elected to just suspend background checks for everyone. So I devoured some room service eggs, steamed my best polo, and walked 8th Street to Lafayette Square. There it was, like a postcard brought to life. The White House. I walked straight up to the gate, where a stray cat was nursing its kittens by the empty security booth. A man with dreadlocks was scaling the fence. He waved to me from the parapet, then dropped to the ground and elbowed the gate open for me before running to the Rose Garden to make the nightly news. I entered gingerly and made my way up the path. Near the West Wing, I took a moment to appreciate the history of the sacred ground on which I was standing, and watched the Secret Service tackle that protester. Some of these guys have a future in the NFL. I heard a creaking sound from behind some bushes, and saw a man in a chef's hat light up a cigarette next to an open screen door. I waved hello. "Mind if I come in this way?" I asked. "Sure," he replied with a profanity. "Be my guest." So in I went through the West Wing kitchen, where rows of gourmet chefs were pounding burger patties and sliding racks of them into the freezer. I proceeded to the corridor, which was empty except for a weeping woman in a business skirt, heels clicking down the hallway. I saw another Secret Service agent. I told him I was there to see the president. He shrugged and gestured down the hall. I smelled liquor on his breath, so I made a note to circle back with him later on. As I walked through the empty office bullpens, I heard a man screaming at the top of his lungs. A shrill, scratchy gorilla scream from a man who has had practice. I tiptoed to the door and peeked my head through, holding my breath. This was my first glimpse of the Oval Office and of the tilted mass of the 45th President of the United States, unloading a day's worth of anger on a cowering Steve Bannon, Reince Priebus, and Sean Spicer. As they shuffled out of the room, I stepped in, and the tone changed instantly. The president sat back in his chair and smiled. "Kelsey," he said, "I heard you said some very nice things about my golf courses." It was like a storm cloud blew out of the room. It felt like it was just the two of us in the whole entire world. I bathed in the warmth and charisma that I remembered from our previous encounters, now amplified by the trappings of power. Being in a room with Donald Trump is like meeting the uncle you always dreamed of having. We quickly agreed on some ground rules. The archive must be tremendous. I must be the kind of guy he can count on. And don't tell Melania. Tell her what? I don't know. But I agreed to all three. Now for some full disclosure. Don't worry, I'll keep my pants on. I've been called many things in my life, including some choice four-letter words. But nobody has ever said I was a political kind of guy. My wife, Peg, is a lifelong Democrat. She volunteered for Mondale when she was 29, and she's been 29 ever since. I consider myself an independent, though I usually vote Republican, so I can afford to have a wife. So if you hadn't guessed already, I did support President Trump in 2016. I was sick of how all the other candidates from both parties had forgotten about people like me, the guys and gals who work hard for their families and still think this country is actually pretty great. I don't want to feel bad for having a nice car and a nice house in a nice neighborhood. If having a good life makes me the problem, I'm not sure how 8 more years of the Clinton cabal was going to be the solution. But let me get off my soapbox here. This book draws from both public and private documents, transcripts of conversations in person and over the phone, interviews, and fun facts, which I hope will paint an accurate picture of the unique and historic presidency of Donald John Trump. Whether you support him or can't stand him, I hope you can put your feet up, crack a cold one, and find something to laugh about, other than my handicap. After all, in the words of the great Jimmy Buffett, if we weren't all crazy, we'd just go insane. Cheers. Kelsey Nelson. Interview. The Library. Mr. President, it is an honor to be here.
Look at this guy. Strong guy. Look at you.
Thank you, sir. I try to stay healthy.
Incredible.
So this is our first interview for your presidential library project. I wanted to note a couple things at the beginning.
Very big.
Most presidents wait until...
You can say it. They die.
No, sir, that's not what I was going to say.
Yeah, I should call the Secret Service in. You just threatened me.
No, I didn't, sir.
I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I play. I kid.
Most presidents wait until the end of their term as president before they start assembling their presidential library.
I think it's an incredible idea to give people a living document. A living document.
General Kelly told me that you want to get yours out before Obama's library opens.
Unbelievable. This Obama, what right does this guy have to have a library? To open a library. What's it going to have? Kenyan books? Half Kenyan books? Why does he get to build this library while I'm president? He should have to build his library while he was president. His time is done. He's putting it in Chicago. And in Chicago, there's so much death. There's so much killing. People can't even go to the play, Chicago, because there's so much violence in the balconies. What about the gun deaths there? It's so incredible. People wear their theater blacks to do the show Chicago, and then you have theater black on theater black violence, and that's so incredible. Where are you from again?
I was born in Cleveland.
You want a Coke?
No, thank you.
Look at this. See this button?
Yes, I've heard about this, sir. Very charming.
You push the button, you get a Diet Coke.
Of course. Well, there's more to your job than that, I imagine.
Yeah, a lot of work. It's a lot of work. Documents, lots of important people to meet, dignitaries, big deals, trade.
Yes, sir.
Immigration, DACA, healthcare. So many issues. Obama left a mess, a total and complete mess. This place was so disgusting when we got here. There was soot and dust everywhere, and the furniture was ugly. And let's face it, he killed the country. He ruined the country. I turned the economy around the day I entered office.
Yes, sir. Second, most presidential libraries are buildings that they build. Seems odd to me that as a famous builder, someone whose name is on many buildings.
I built many buildings.
That you would choose to publish your library as a pocket library, as a book.
I can't wait.
Not a physical structure.
We can't wait. Have you ever heard of a blueprint? You know what a blueprint is?
I do, sir. Yes.
Blueprint?
Yes, sir.
A blueprint?
Yes, sir.
The blueprint is something you do before you make the building. And that way, when you build the building and you lay the foundation and the contractors start putting the wiring and all the important stuff, and I know all the stuff. I know all the stuff because this is what I do.
Yes, sir.
I build. You need to make a blueprint. And this book is a beautiful, beautiful blueprint. One of the most beautiful blueprints. And I can't wait for a building. As you know, I have totally recused myself from my businesses. My sons now operate the Trump Organization.
Is that exactly true, sir? I mean, you seem to be participating.
I recused. I totally recused.
Does that have a legal meaning? Because recused is usually in the context of litigation or a trial.
I recused. I removed myself. I recused. I recused. That's the right word. Je recuse. What's your outfit?
Golf and Stream magazine.
One of the great magazines, Golf and Stream. You keep us away from all the streams because, as we know, you know where all the streams are.
Many of them.
And we met on the green, the golf green. We became friends the night they cooked that big fish at Mar-a-Lago.
That's right.
Did you have the fish?
No.
I'm going to get somebody to fix that. I'll get someone to fix that. You got to go down to Mar-a-Lago and get dinner. Have some fun. Have some drinks. Have a few laughs. You know, eat the big fish. Go to Nakatomi Plaza. I'm kidding. I just watched Die Hard again last night. Those terrorists are terrible people. What they did to the Nakatomi building? Did you get that Coke?
Yes. So, I've got a, your aides released some documents that I'm going to assemble and edit together into what I hope is a readable, educational, and with some luck, entertaining history of your presidency in progress. And these interviews that we're doing together will be part of that living document.
Did you see that bird? Look at that bird out there.
That's a big bird.
That's a real bird. What is that? A crow?
That's a very large crow. Or a raven.
That big bird better not come in here.
I imagine that's not really possible for the bird, sir.
You can never trust the Irish. My father used to tell me that. You got Irish blood, don't you?
Yes.
Let me tell you something. Never trust the Irish. You people hide under bridges. You people steal babies in the middle of the night.
I think that's leprechauns or some kind of fairy.
That's why we have to build the wall. Tell me about the libraries.
Well, have you been to any of them?
The libraries?
Have you visited Bill Clinton's presidential library in Little Rock?
No.
Ronald Reagan's in the Simi Valley?
Yeah, I went out in front of it.
What about Lyndon Johnson's in Austin?
No, why would I go there?
Well, I don't know, sir. Some people go.
They shot Kennedy there.
In Austin?
Yeah.
That was Dallas, sir.
That was Oswald, I thought.
Are you planning, sir, on releasing any more of the Kennedy documents that you've chosen to keep classified?
JFK blown away. What else do I have to say is what Billy Joel said in We Didn't Start the Fire. And you can go see him for free at Madison Square Garden, you know? He's playing free concerts all the time. So incredible. He's a really great guy, great piano player. And when I heard those lines, who knows what happened to him? Nobody understands what happened. Nobody knows what happened to Kennedy. And we need to have the truth out. But at the same time, I have learned from trusted people, very smart people, from very, very smart people. I mean, not as smart as me, but very smart people. I kid. And they've shown me some documents that I have to redact. We have to redact some of them. Redacting is the act of not bringing in and not showing the document. Named after the winged dinosaur, the Redactotactyl. The Redactotactyl. The Redactotactyl. It flew with mighty wings and picked up all the Jurassic animals and dropped them wherever they wanted to go. You ever think about that? A bird with lizard skin? That's crazy. It's like it's got a big tongue that can smell, but also fly. Not scarier than a shark. Sharks are the scariest. You ever see a shark?
Yes, sir.
Very frightening.
I agree.
They got big jaws, and they don't care about what they do. They've been around for, like, millions of years, way longer than human beings.
That's true, sir.
You know, if you ask Mike, he'd say everyone showed up 6,000 years ago. The guy's crazy. He believes that there are dinosaurs walking with human beings. Even I know that's not true. Mike's weird. Here's all I'm going to say. If you have to sit down with Mike, you can have a code word. And if you say it, I'll come in and stop the conversation. Because that guy is boring, let me tell you. He's got eyes like a shark, and he's always moving. Fidgeting. Do you want another Coke?
No.
Anyway, Kennedy. So there was some information in the documents. We want to release it all. We want the Freedom of Information Act. FIA. FIOA. FIOA. And when we do that, we have an incredible opportunity to make it all available. And some of the things that were redacted were that Jack Ruby had worked for the CIA for 2 years prior to owning the club. He also had met with Oswald the night before, which put him in the same place, and they knew each other. Another document revealed that George H.W. Bush was stationed in Dallas that day. Some people are saying he was the second gunman, but I'm also hearing he may be the first. And the reward was the CIA top leadership. After having no documented responsibility at the CIA up until 1976. Oh, and then they made him president. Trust me, they would have made him president in 1980. I don't want to get into the Reagan stuff. They made an attempt on him to try to get Bush in office early. Then we would have had the Iran-Iraq war in the mid-80s. Anyway, it's a crazy document, and I wish I could share it. So many incredible things. You married?
Yes.
What's your wife look like?
She's a beautiful woman.
Yeah, sure. I want stats. Blonde. How tall?
Oh, she's 5'1". She's a brunette.
Whoa, a little spinner.
What?
Little spinner.
No, sir.
She spin around like a top?
No, sir.
Pretty hot.
Sir,
I'd like to meet her. Have I met her?
Oh, she would love that. I don't think so.
I'll meet her. All right, are we done? I'd like to get my day started by 11. You can hang around and finish up.
The Donald.
Archivist's Note. For those of you who haven't been living under a rock for the past 30 years, one of the most intriguing public figures this country has managed to produce is Donald J. Trump, who rose to prominence in the cutthroat world of New York City real estate in the 1980s. Not satisfied with a life surrounded by decadent wealth and beautiful women, he agreed to swap places with me. Oh, was I daydreaming? I mean, he decided to enter public service and became President of the United States. But before we learn more about his presidency, I wanted to take this opportunity to learn more about the man behind the man. For today's interview, the president invited me to join him in the private residence on the second floor of the White House. I held my breath as I walked up the grand staircase and into the center hall, thinking of every president since Adams who had retreated here after a long day of tending to the nation's business. "Kelsey! Kelsey!" came a whisper from the door in the middle of the hallway. "In here." President Trump was standing on the west side of the yellow oval room near the entrance to the Truman balcony, towing a chalk line that bisected the room. "You can come across. You can. She doesn't care if I have visitors. People visit. We split the floor. It's a good deal." He led me through the living room, where a half dozen or so copies of each of the books he'd co-authored over the years were scattered on the bookshelves. I followed him into the master bedroom, where he climbed into his big bed and pulled up the sheets. Early life. Interview. Trump's childhood. "So, Mr. President, you're a real New Yorker."
"Through and through."
"You're the consummate New Yorker. People can't think of New York City without thinking of Donald Trump."
"They think of New York, they think of Trump."
"All over the country, when I'd shop at Macy's, I'd see your products. Donald Trump mattresses, Donald Trump ties, Donald Trump suits. Everywhere but New York."
"We're getting there."
"Well, I wanted to talk about growing up in the city, sir."
"I'm so tired."
"It's 2 p.m, sir."
"So tired. When's Let's Make a Deal on?"
"Well, I don't know, sir."
"Okay, I'm going to find it in the guide. The TV guide. Remember the guide? I love the guide. They tell me what's on. When I was a kid, I watched some of the best TV. Is that what we're talking about?"
"Well, let's start at the beginning. You were born and raised in Queens?"
"I grew up in Queens. I grew up in Jamaica Estates, Queens, out near Hollis in Jamaica, Queens."
"Born in Jamaica, Queens. Very nice. You made it your life's mission to make a splash in New York City real estate."
"Where is... What? Family Feud? When did they put Family Feud on?"
"Well, I think it's on every day, sir."
"Yeah, but now it's where Let's Make a Deal used to be. So now I don't know where Let's Make a Deal is."
"Well, I don't know, sir."
"Look at this guy. Does it say WGN?
Yes, sir."
"I don't know. I don't watch that Family Feud. Steve Harvey, good guy, but too much. It's too much. It makes me laugh. I can't think when I'm listening to him. Now, here's the thing. I grew up in Queens. I grew up in a very small house. Grew up in a very tiny house. My mother and my brother and my sister and my father. My mother was a Scottish woman, and she was very tough. They called her the Scottish Angel because of her beautiful flowing red hair. And my dad was even tougher. This was a guy who used to go to work, come home, and he didn't want to be bothered. But what can I tell you? And this is very true. I'll tell you this only one time, so incredible. I used to go into the neighborhood and play with all the kids, and we'd have fun. I used to throw rocks at little girls and wood. We'd play stickball in the ditch, all the New York street games, grab the bottle cap, stink up the bus stop, and there was bucket ball. You'd put a bucket in the middle of the street, and you'd throw a ball in it. And there was kick the can, guess the Asian, sever the sissy's pinky on the Q train. That's where you'd find the biggest sissy on the train. You can always spot a sissy, because they got a lollipop. Then you'd go up and you'd take some dental floss and just zip, pull off the pinky. I had a necklace of sissy pinkies when I was a kid. Believe me, I had a very big necklace. But my brother was a real troublemaker. He never wanted to get in line. He was always going for the attention. Always the big guy at school. Always the big guy everywhere. And he and Dad used to get into a lot of fights. And my mother would sit in the kitchen going, stop it, stop it, stop it, stop it, stop it. I'm going crazy. I'm going crazy. I feel myself losing my mind. And I would hide with my sister. You know, my sister's now a great judge. And I would hide with my sister under the bed. My mother and I used to play a fun game called Mommy's Crazy. When I would run and hide, and my mother would scream, I'm losing my mind! And run around the house with a shovel. And then when she got tired and fell asleep, I'd run out of the house. Then I'd go to school. And let me tell you, I was not a good kid. I'm not gonna lie, believe me. They used to call detentions DTs for Donald Trump. And I remember my Jewish buddy and I, we used to go up to girls and snap their bras. We'd snap their bra straps. And what that does is they didn't understand I was doing them a favor. Because you pull back on their itty bitty titties and it makes them stiffer. And that's how I wound up in military school. And I promise you, in the next year of my administration, I will be forming an international community of flat-chested women called the Itty Bitty Titty Committee. It's a lifelong dream. The Congressional Itty Bitty Titty Committee will come up with a budget proposal that provides for breast augmentation for all flat-chested women in the United States. Talk to nunnies about it, because I'm not signing any bills. You talk to nunnies about it. Nunnies knows everything. Nunnies explains it all.
So, growing up, did you want to follow your father into business?
Well, I mean, I followed my father everywhere because I had to go with him in the car. I kid. I followed my father into business because my older brother, Fred, he didn't want anything to do with it. He was a flyboy. He'd fly around the world, and he had a bit of a drinking problem. It was very sad, very lonely guy. And every Sunday, they'd have a big fight. My brother Fred and my father, and I was the one who was always there to take care of things. So I'd bring my daddy lunch at work, and I'd go with my father, and I remember one of my earliest, and this is so incredible, one of my earliest experiences, and family's so important. That's why I work with my sons. That's why I work with my daughter. And I don't work with all of them, but the ones that are important. And I went with my daddy to Ocean Parkway, and we had to throw people out. And listen, it was a lot of blacks. It was a lot of blacks. It was a lot of Latinos. And these people living in squalor, just living in total squalor. So disgusting. I felt bad for these guys. I felt for these people. But they had to go. And my father was trying to change the community. And this is what I said. What have you got to lose? Because I saw how bad it was for the blacks firsthand, and that was before the Warriors took over the subway system.
Your father encouraged you.
He encouraged. Daddy said, you know what? You're the best. You're the most tremendous. You could do so much more than me. Move into Manhattan. Take it over. Dad, I'm so weak. Dad, no. He said, I can't do it, son. I can't go to Manhattan. I said, Daddy, no! And his body disappeared. And now he just sits with me. And he says, you could do it. Donald, lose yourself, Donald. Grab that woman, Donald. Build the building. So that's why in the late 70s, I started investing in properties around Manhattan and built the Trump name into the empire it is today. And just like the rebels, we're now the empire. 588-2300 empire. And all our carpets are empire carpets. And if you go to the very top of Trump Tower, you'll see that there is a giant dome and it's designed so beautifully by this incredible guy who designed a perfect dome that reflects sound. And I built that in honor of my mother. And my mother can go up there anytime she wants, anytime, day or night. And she can scream to her heart's content. And it will echo throughout the city and all through time. And hopefully someone like Jesus or someone will hear her time screams and come to the future and save us from ISIS. My mother was a screamer. She was known for it. For her 90th birthday, we had a map commission of all her favorite places to go and scream. She loved to scream. Take a look. They still use it as a placemat in some diners out there in Queens. Tube time. Shows I loved growing up.
We have reconstructed a TV guide showing a typical night of television President Trump watched as a child. Unbelievably, many records from that early era of television have been lost, since there was no economical way to record broadcasts before the invention of videotape. So we depend on the sharp memories of amateur TV historians like the president. And we can only wonder what other great programs which we have absolutely no record of that have been forgotten and forever lost. How Doll Do This, 7 p.m.
In every episode, the ventriloquist was surprised by his little wooden man's tricks. But he was never pleased. No matter what new skills he learned, the little wooden man could never make the big man in the gray hat proud of him. He'd dance and sing and bring his friends around, but at the end of the day, he'd end up back in his box, his oak eyes cracking with the effort of trying to push out a tear. Sad.
Dyke Van Dyke, 7:30 p.m.
One of the greats.
The Underwater Priest, 8 p.m.
This guy could swim underwater, and no one knew he could. But he was a priest, and he solved mysteries.
Nozo the Uncle, 8:30 p.m.
This was a show where everyone's favorite funny uncle would come from the city and transform into a playful clown whenever the boy's parents were downstairs.
My Two Sons I Hate, 9 p.m.
This was the story of a suburban dad smoking his pipe on the porch, watching his two sons have a fist fight over a lie he'd told them.
Help! My Husband is a Warlock, 9:30 p.m.
A woman marries a man who turns out to be the kind of magician who bought his tricks from the devil, and she never gets help. No one ever helps her.
Herpy, the car with venereal disease, 10 p.m.
It was a car that was all white, and once in a while these awful sores would open up on it, and that was the show.
The Mother's Brothers, 10:30 p.m.
This was ahead of its time by about 20 years. It was a variety show, one of a kind. The two brothers hosted it, and they sent their mother to die in Vietnam, and they couldn't forgive themselves. So they hosted a show where they used skits and music to hold each other responsible for their mother's death.
The Evening News with Bronson Cash, 11 p.m.
Bronson would smoke two packs of cigarettes every night over the course of a broadcast until you could barely see his suit. We watched every night during the McCarthy hearings as his ashtray piled up, a mountain of wet tobacco, casting a shadow at his desk until his last broadcast when Bronson stood up, poured kerosene on all those old cigarettes, and with words that would echo throughout history, lit himself on fire, shrieking, "How's this for decency?" as the whole studio burned down. The statue of Prometheus at the Rockefeller Center ice rink marks the spot where they found his head.
The Tonight News with Gus Van Harvey, 12 a.m.
This newsman was the most famous Quaker since the oatmeal pig. Gus always told the truth, and he didn't care who was listening, which was the slogan of his program in the 50s. Woody Allen's radio days. Gus was America's conscience during the Korean War and a gentleman of the old school. He'd threaten his wife on the air, signing off with a warning that he was coming home in a mood, so she better watch her step. I learned a lot from him.
The Late Late News with Spit Brunkle, 1 a.m.
A real muckraker. Spit and his crew weren't afraid to get their nose in the sawdust, digging up stories about everyone from tavern boys and oyster girls to grimy beat cops and women of a certain age. I remember Spit's gin-soaked southern drawl calling for a nuclear first strike against every country he could pronounce.
A Leader Comes of Age, New York Military School Journals. Homesickness, September 4th, 1959.
It was a long ride up here. I'm already missing my old shithole in Queens. It was a typical day when I finally left. Dad was screaming and choking Fred while Mommy was crying in the kitchen. It was hard to leave, but I had to. I gave my brother a sucker punch goodbye and was out the door. Boy, I'm sure gonna miss my family. I have a sister, too.
School Spirit, September 14th, 1961.
People always compare our school to West Point, but does West Point have an apple orchard and a pumpkin patch? No. Last week, I took a wagon ride out to a cornfield and saw a scarecrow ghost. Then I found a corn maze. I made it to the middle in record time. So easy. Just walk through the corn walls to the center. Following a maze path is for losers. That's how General Cornwall Jackson got his name. He walked right through that corn wall and killed all the Indians while yelling, "Surprise! Shove it up your ass, West Point!"
Leadership, October 13th, 1961.
I was put in charge of my first unit today. I've discovered that if I claim absolute authority but delegate all responsibility, I can spend the day watching TV and people will be too scared to ask what I'm doing. I built a hammock by tying my bunkmate's clothes together. It's incredible. I just lie there and watch Calvin and the Colonel.
October 10th, 1962.
I did it! I've been promoted from the commander of A Company to an even more powerful post sitting at a desk. Everyone says that I did such a great job commanding these easily bullied freshmen that I'll never be put in charge of anyone again.
Role models. May 5th, 1963.
I've been reading a lot about Howard Hughes. I really admire his tremendous business mind and obsessive attention to detail. From keeping jars of piss to worrying about nuclear fallout polluting his bones, this guy's cracked the code. As the recipient of the New York Military Academy's highest honor, the Neatness and Order Medal, I might even be able to teach him a thing or two. I don't know if my military school experience is prepping me for combat, but I am learning how to keep a clean room with tight bed sheets, which qualifies me to work at any Weston in the world.
Brothers in Arms, September 20th, 1962.
I made so many friends when I arrived. Bucky and Spuds and Brooklyn. But one of the great tragedies of my time at the academy was losing my friend Roger. He caught me getting sweet with myself using a picture of his girlfriend. I'll never forget the look in his eyes and his last words. "Jesus, Trump, what are you doing?" And like the old saying goes, young cadets don't die. They just back slowly out of the room and ask for a transfer.
The drill instructor. April 12th, 1962.
That drill instructor is a real meanie, so I got a job at the mess hall, and I'm slowly poisoning him.
December 8th, 1962.
The drill instructor finally died! Unbelievable.
Becoming a Man. January 21st, 1963.
I finally did it! All my towels and sheets are folded perfectly. I'm finally a soldier.
Letters from Home, March 4th, 1963.
I got a letter from Dad today. He told me the Andragottis down the street are dumping their garbage out on the sidewalk. Why won't any of his soft, fat-fingered sons do something about it? The neighborhood's changing. Love you, Pop.
The Kennedy assassination, November 22nd, 1963.
Kennedy was shot today. Not surprised. He had a very big head. Easy target. They say this Poindexter Oswald shot him. I'm not buying it.
Vietnam, April 9th, 1964.
Apparently, Vietnam isn't just a luxury vacation destination. It's also a slowly developing colonial conflict. My feet hurt.
Graduation, May 15th, 1964.
Graduation day. I got a note from Dad. One day without a failure doesn't make you not a failure. More of that understated German wit. I love you, Daddy.
Archivist's note. An evening with General Mattis. One Tuesday night in autumn, after the president had screamed his face red at two cabinet members who resigned, leaked, and were then forgotten, General Kelly pursed his lips and clicked his castanets, thereby directing everyone present to make their exits, and quickly. After the rush, I found myself in an unfamiliar corridor, hastily sorting my notes and dreaming of the Caesar wrap whose crunch was waiting for me back at the Garden Inn, when I heard the jagged hoot of men's laughter echo off the marble. Following the sound, I peeked my head through an open door into a firelit lounge where General Mattis sat sipping brandy with some off-duty Marine security guards. "Where were you in Vietnam?" he barked when he saw me, showing his teeth. "Masters in English," I stammered. "Graduate school. Deferment." The men all laughed. As my face turned red, I darted my eyes toward the waning fire and at the painting of the Kalmar Nickel sailing above the hearth. But Mattis gestured for me to join them yet, offering me a glass of the sweet stuff. "Some of the most terrifying stories I know from that godforsaken jungle are from men who never went," he whispered. Each of us leaned in about a foot and a half and inhaled sharply. "Perhaps the one I remember best was told to me by the president himself. I'll tell it to you now as I heard it from him. But drink up, boys, for these words are keen to stay with you for life." He leaned back and held up his hand, speaking the president's words while moving his fingers like a puppet's mouth until we all got the picture and he stopped. Apocalypse Al. Donald Trump's Vietnam.
Fifth Avenue seemed to be going on forever. The cab was moving slowly. The traffic was backed up from a parade for the Mets that was going on downtown. It was so hot. The sticky slime that was forming under my belly punch was starting to have a scent of its own. And I'll take it. I'll take that smell over the rotten garbage streets of New York City in the 60s. There's a creep that happens in your mind. A slow bleed with visions of torture, foot pain like you've never experienced, permeating your body. I wasn't going to tell them. I wanted to fight. I wasn't going to be the messenger. No, no. That wasn't my job. I was a soldier, and my feet were the infantry. I couldn't tell them, because I couldn't tell myself. Ah! The spur! The spur burned! As the cabbie slowed to a halt at the traffic light, I took off my shoe and looked at the pulsing lump. Removing the shoe was difficult. It was squeezed over my foot, which had expanded in the heat. Round and hard, the throb, the ache, the sharp pain of the spur. I don't want anyone to find out about you, spur. Get back in your sock! But you can see it. Pressing out, almost as if it had eyes, and it was staring back at you. You'll never fight, Donald. You'll never fight anything but me. Suddenly the cabbie spoke up. Say, blood, you going all the way downtown, jive-ass turkey? I said, yeah, so cool, man. I thought I already told you where I was going when I got in the cab, my brother. Yeah, well, there's a lot of traffic, blood. You want to hit up on the down low? What? You want to go through Times Square? Sure. Get nasty? Yeah, I'll get nasty. Now we were deep in the heart of it. Look at the filth. Was this what our boys were dying for over there? The signs were hanging, looming over the square, the shadows reaching long. Who knew what was down those street paths? Guys leaving porn shops with their dicks still out, little pricks lighting up the streets like fireflies. The hookers with their big hair, smoking cigarettes, looking at the man in the suit in the cab. They were looking at me. They were seeing inside me. Lust. A lust and a passion. But it wasn't for them. It was for service. My spurs were working against me. They were my own Viet Cong, right in my feet, lying in wait at night, stinging me with pain. I thought about chopping them off. Then I could get a nickname like Stubbs in the military. But they wouldn't take me without feet. I knew I had to go. The cab jumped the curb and slammed right into the front of the recruiting office in the middle of Times Square. A fire hydrant opened and shot a fountain of water in the air. Clean, cleansing water. Water that flowed over me like I was a stone. Water that made me white and clean. Water that covered the cab and flowed wherever it could go. Water that went into the military training center. Water that interrupted the cabbie's cries of, "Oh, damn! Oh, damn!" I heard the mocking laughter of my spurs. "Water won't stop us," the spurs whistled. They whistled a little tune that I came to know as the spur folk had since the age before. In the valley of the arch, in the wrinkled sands, grows a little lump that has no hands. Onward, a determined march, skin nor bone could not deter. It raises up a ruddy bump. Hi-ho, we greet the little bone spur. It toils away, singing a little tune. Bumpy, lumpy, humpy, glur. Turdy, lurdy, gurdy, whir. I am you and you are me. My voice is yours and now you're free. Moany, groany, bony spur. Hiddledy, diddledy, pap. The little lump finished its tune and danced all the way back to White Plains, where it lived in a little spur hole. Time stretches and snaps in this place. I had no way of knowing how long I'd been talking to the recruiter. He leaned forward and asked, "What was that song?" "I didn't sing it." "Yes, you did." "No, my bone spurs sang it. Are you ready to see my secret? Can you hear my secret? Can I trust you? Are you an assassin?" "No, I'm an army recruiter." "My bone spurs are singing. They don't want me to join. They say that war is just another of man's futile efforts to control nature. That ultimately we're just simple animals. Monkey, tigers, giraffes, preying on one another. Sharp-eyed apes and dull wall-eyed sharks, all of them chasing each other in an endless cycle of destruction and rebirth. I'm not going to Vietnam because my daddy says I don't have to." "What's that?" "I'm not going to Vietnam because my daddy says I don't have to." Those were the bone spurs speaking. Their daddy. I felt the bone spurs move all the way up into my throat, and they started talking for me. "I'll ruin you. I'll destroy you. I'll kill your whole family. Do you know who my dad is? My dad is Fred Trump, and I'll ruin you. I got tons of money, you stupid simpleton. You're nothing but a meat sack that's ready to get peppered with bullets, and we all know it. You're a human flesh shield." Then he signed my form, and I went, "Thank you," and it was straight to Rockefeller Center to the Rainbow Room, where suddenly my bone spurs felt perfectly fine. So I had a wonderful night out with a beautiful woman named Shelley Duvall.
Finished with the story, Mattis stood up. "Okay, everybody. See you tomorrow." Alumni Correspondence. December 7, 2011. "Dear Mr. Trump, thank you for your recent donation of the multiple copies of your book, Think Big and Kick Ass in Business and in Life, to the New York Military Academy. While we are happy to include works from our alumni in our campus library, we will be unable to accommodate your request of a receipt indicating the value of your gift of a new curriculum being worth $12 million. We trust you will be satisfied with the enclosed receipt valuing the book at its cover price of $29.95. Sincerely, Colonel Bart Carls, retired. Dean of Alumni, New York Military Academy." August 12, 2016. Dear Mr. Trump, we are writing in response to your most recent letter to remind you that we, in fact, never feature alumni on the cover of our monthly newsletter intended for the young men enrolled at our school. A brief informal consultation with our board of directors affirms that our organization would have minimal interest in starting a new publication for the purpose of promoting our alumni, their business interests, or entertainment ventures. Also, despite your kind offer to rename our bullshit buildings, we are content to have our campus facilities continue to bear the names of the great tacticians of history, Washington, Patton, Napoleon, etc. It would be inappropriate and confusing to have our cafeteria named after Don Jr., for example. People wouldn't know who we were talking about. Also, apropos of nothing, a man has been calling from payphones in New York City making similar suggestions for our newsletter and building names, and we wish he would stop. Sincerely, Colonel Bart Carls, retired, Dean of Alumni, New York Military Academy. January 8, 2017. Dear President Trump, we are pleased to send you the limited edition first issue of our New York Military Academy's alumni magazine, Alumnorama, which it is our great privilege to inform you features none other than you, Donald J. Trump, the 45th President of the United States, as our first cover story. Our board, by unanimous vote in a formal meeting, has made your most recent suggested changes to the names of our buildings and to our curriculum and sends their warm congratulations. We hope you enjoy the publication and will consider visiting us very soon. Sincerely, Colonel Bart Carls, retired, Dean of Alumni, Eric and Don Jr., Tough Guys, Good Boys Academy. The View from the Top. Interview. The 1980s.
You want anything? You want little hot dogs?
Sure.
It's little hot dog day.
You just have these in a drawer?
Yeah. They put a fresh bag of hot dogs in here every day, warmed in a plastic bag.
Oh, like a steam bag and they dump it in there?
Uh-huh. And then I use a little toothpick and I pull them out. I love that water. They say hot dog water is good for your health.
Yes, sir. Well, sir, I have to tell you, I'm having a great time sorting through some of your documents here. We found a little trunk of newspaper clippings about you from the 80s.
The 1980s.
You know, you were in the New York Post more than any other person back then.
That's right.
And it seemed like you were having a heck of a time.
Those are great days, a lot of fun. We had a great time. We had a great time in the 1980s. Ronald Reagan and the DeLorean, where he took a bullet, and the Luft balloons, and all the other fun things that happened.
We found a lot of pictures of you with some beautiful women out at clubs and enjoying the nightlife.
The nightlife. I'd go to Studio 54, and I'd hang out with all the hot celebrities and see all the great people, and I'd rub up against them, and it was a wild time. A lot of wacky people. But the truth was, I was a builder. I meet a lot of people today, and I go, I think I gave a hot one to your mommy. And they look at me, and they say, you probably did. And they all love that. Did you see the pictures of me on the bed?
Yes, sir, I did.
I did a lot of those poses. I always loved being sideways on a bed, laying there with my robe loose. I think it's a beautiful portrait of me at my most relaxed. I don't get time to relax, especially in the 1980s. There was no time to relax because I was building an empire.
Yes, sir.
My father could never accomplish what I accomplished.
You brought the family business into Manhattan, sir, and you really made a splash.
We were a huge splash everywhere. All the buildings, all the women. And you see me with all the beautiful women, Suzanne Plachette, Judith Light, so incredible. All the great women, Margot Kidder, the original Lois Lane. I remember visiting the set of Superman 2, and we had a wonderful time. Chris Reeves, great guy, big horse guy. And of course, the horses undid him in the end. And I warned him. I knew it was going to happen. I said, you're riding loose. You're riding fast, Chris. But he wouldn't listen to me. And I said that to him in 1982. Where do you ride horses anywhere in New York? Except in Central Park. But that's in a carriage. The bridle path. Jackie O. And of course, the ghost that rode that horse during Kennedy's funeral. The same ghost that rode the horse in Lincoln's funeral. And not a lot of people know that. It was the same ghost.
Well, you know, you bought the plaza and then you sold it at a loss during this time. Now, wasn't the plaza meant to be the crown jewel of your empire?
As you know, the plaza was an incredible purchase, but the thing was that Leona, I mean, that woman, she was a tough lady, and I'd mix it up with the best. You know, a woman like Leona Helmsley, usually you'd see her and go, whoa, boy, whoa, there's a witch! Hold still and grab a garlic. But with Leona, she'd fill up a room. And she had a powerful way of negotiating and doing business, so you could never underestimate Leona. I purchased it at too high a price point, and unfortunately, we had a lot of problems with the plumbing and the electric in the building. And at the time, let's face it, Central Park was someplace you didn't want to be. You had the Central Park Five roving the park, murdering and raping anyone they could, and it was only when I took a full page ad out that they stopped. I did the same thing for the Son of Sam in the 1970s. And if the paper had listened to me and put the ad out, that dog would have stopped telling him to kill, and it would have said love instead. It wasn't the dog's fault. And so we settled in. I put my offices in the plaza because, of course, Trump Tower is being built at the time. And speaking of time, from my office, I would always hear this clock ticking and ticking, saying tick, tock, tick, tock, tick, tock, tick, tock. And I'd say, what the hell is that? And my staff would say, what? And I would say, is there a clock in here? Where's the clock? And then I'd hear it singing, welcome to our world. Tick-tock, welcome to our tick-tock, welcome to our world of toys, tick-tock, tick-tock. And I'd say, I'm losing my mind! But after a few weeks, I found out it was just the old FAO Schwartz clock across the street, which is gone now because kids stopped playing with toys, and Schwartz couldn't keep up with the iPad or the Nintendo, or us.
So you went from a small-town real estate developer to building an empire. And this is when you wrote your first book, The Art of the Deal.
The Art of the Deal, one of the great books. I loved it so much. When I read it finally, I said, I can't believe I wrote this. And it was true. I wrote The Art of the Deal because I wanted everyone to know the secrets. Because I have nothing to hide. And here's the thing. I was giving it away for free. I'm giving it away for free. I mean, you had to pay for the book, of course, right? You gotta pay for the book, but once you get the book, it's all in there. It's totally free, and all the information. Anybody could do it. I gave everybody a blueprint on how to buy massively depressed real estate in Manhattan, and there was a lot of it. I used to teach a class at the Learning Annex, and I would go there and say, welcome back, your dreams were your ticket out. And the studio audience would clap, and I'd say, okay, sweat hogs, it's time for you to learn about how the real estate is done. And because of that, I got on TV. And the truth is, there was a lot of great television. Different Strokes, Facts of Life, Mama's Family, so many great shows. Kids Are People Too, People Are Talking, all the great ones. Donahue. I mean, I never missed a Donahue. Donahue had me on 2 or 3 times a week. I was one of the great guests. I'd like to say to Phil, your hair was black when you started and gray by the time I was done with you. Because I stressed the guy out. I used to show up a lot. And boy, his wife, Marlo Thomas, what a beauty. She was a real hippie, but she was a real beauty. And of course, Danny Thomas's daughter. And that's almost like doing Danny Thomas, which could be a dream. He was such a great talent. Finally, I told Donahue, I gotta walk it back because I'm on too much. And what's gonna happen when they rely on seeing me? It's your show, Phil. And that was it. And then I was off to Oprah.
You started getting a lot of press.
Yes, but you couldn't because in the early 1980s, they had the rotary phones. But by the late 1980s, of course, they had the push-button phones. I remember a day when you called the operator up and you said, what are you wearing? What's going on, honey? And all the operators were beautiful. Of course, because you were imagining them because you were just hearing the voice. So you'd imagine who they were and you'd have a good time. When you were lonely, you wouldn't even need to go down to 42nd Street or hide in the dressing room at the Bambergers. You'd call the operator, and you'd keep her on long enough, and then you'd get your little bust. And then you'd go, connect me to somebody, because I'm very lonely. I used to spend hours talking to the operator. She was my best friend, and then I learned there was more than one.
Speaking of 42nd Street, you know, a lot has changed in New York.
42nd Street.
A lot changed in New York in the 90s.
42nd Street used to be a place for bums and whores and people who dealt drugs, but Rudy cleaned it all up. But let's face it, you had a lot of ghetto kids stealing hubcaps. You had a lot of heroin addicts. You had a lot of jerk places. I went into a movie